which essentially declared that those states would nullify any federal law that banned free speech. And so from the very beginning, politicians have, some politicians have tried to destroy the Constitution. And the chief among them was Alexander Hamilton, and I write about him in my book, Hamilton's Curse. And so when you read about Lincoln and what he did with the Constitution, I see it as the culmination or the victory, if you will, of the cabal of men in American politics that existed since the founders, the type of men, not the exact same people, the type of men who really wanted a blank slate as a constitution. They wanted unlimited governmental power. What a shocker. And Hamilton really made that argument. Just one piece of background I'll give you is that Hamilton was the founding father of central banking in America. And he was responsible for the first central bank, the Bank of the United States. And when he and Jefferson debated it before George Washington asked both of them to write up the case for and against constitutionality of a bank run by politicians out of a nation's capital. That's where Hamilton invented the notion of implied powers of the Constitution. There was no delegated power in the Constitution to create a bank run by politicians. In fact, the National Bank was debated at the Constitutional Convention and rejected there. And so did get the bank after all, but Hamilton opened the door for this idea of implied powers. And I'll give you one quote. I'm quoting a historian named Clinton Rossiter, who was a liberal historian who applauded the fact that Hamilton was so clever and so sneaky in undermining the Constitution. And he said this, his doctrine of implied powers would essentially render the Constitution useless as a tool for limiting government if the limits of government were simply left up to the imaginations of ambitious politicians. I mean, that's what Rossiter is saying was the critique of this. And of course, the people who wanted this to use the doctrine of implied powers, they were yeah, that's what we want. That's what we want. We want unlimited power. And so, and they eventually got it under Lincoln. And so, I think, so you have to understand, in my opinion, that Jefferson's view of the Constitution, which prevailed for the most part until the 1860s, was that strict construction, that the Constitution delegated certain powers by the states to the central government for their own mutual benefit, for the mutual benefit of the states, and all other powers are reserved to the people and to the states, respectively, under the 10th Amendment. Hamilton looked at the Constitution exactly the opposite way. He saw it as a potential rubber stamp for anything the government would ever do. If you can twist the words of the Constitution sufficiently to make the case that anything the government does, whatever you're doing, is in fact constitutional. It'll have the aura of being constitutional, no matter what it is. And that is what has happened to constitutional law over the years. Constitutional law is basically a large body of case law that explains to lawyers and judges how to destroy the constitutional limits on government. And the Civil War years was the watershed for this. This was the first big break with the Jeffersonian tradition. In a very serious way. And so from the time of the founding until the 1860s, president after president vetoed the economic agenda that we talked about last week of the Whigs and then later the Republicans, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, John Tyler. They all essentially said, I see no room in this for the Constitution. That all ended under Lincoln, as far as that goes. Okay, and so so when Lincoln came into office, he was, the historians were pretty quick to start calling him a dictator, but a good dictator. And if you read the chapter of The Real Lincoln, you read these quotes. I might as well read one or two of them for you. Where Clinton Rossiter, the same historian I mentioned earlier, he said, Lincoln's amazing disregard for the Constitution was considered by nobody as legal. And then he praised Lincoln as a great dictator and a true Democrat. How about that, linking dictatorship to democracy in the same sentence? We don't usually hear that. If I give public speeches about this, I ask people which part of the Constitution allows for the creation of a dictatorship. And of course, most people laugh at that. Another quote, James Fort Rhodes was a famous American historian. He wrote a big, long history of America that was something like 18 volumes by the time he finished. And this was the early 20th century. And he wrote that this, never had the power of a dictator fallen into safer and nobler hands. And so it was widely acknowledged by generations of historians that Lincoln behaved like a dictator. He pretty much declared himself to be a dictator. And a lot of academics today and politicians approve of that for obvious reasons. The politicians want to grab on to dictatorial power. And since Lincoln has been made into a secular saint, they think they can get away with it if they latch on to the Lincoln myth. I mentioned on the chat, public chat at the beginning there, that even the president of Pakistan in 07, when he suspended habeas corpus and declared martial law, one reason he gave for it was it's legitimate because Abe Lincoln did it. Even Pakistanis are saying these things. But there is more than just that. I have a number of people whose names I wrote down here who have written in favor of what Lincoln did, in favor of the fact that he established a precedent that an American president can just destroy the Constitution and declare himself dictator. James McPherson wrote a whole book called Lincoln's Second American Revolution, where he praises the fact that Lincoln ignored the Constitution in so many ways, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Gary Wills, the historian, he praises what he calls Lincoln's open-air sleight of hand. He's referring to some of Lincoln's rhetoric to justify his actions. For example, when he deported Congressman Clement Vallandigham of Ohio, who was the most outspoken member of Congress, a Democrat from Ohio, one of the things Lincoln said was, must I shoot the poor boy who deserts from the army, but not touch a hair on the head of the wily agitator who causes him to desert? And he was referring to Vallandigham as the wily agitator. But the fact is, the Constitution does not give a president the right to deport a member of Congress or to murder a soldier. And so this was sort of flowery rhetoric, and people like Gary Wills praise it because he was so deceptive. And that, by the way, is the whole theme of the book Team of Rivals by the queen of Lincoln called Doris Kearns Goodwin. Now, the whole theme of the book is what a conniving, lying, slick politician Lincoln was. She doesn't use those words, but the theme is what a slick politician he was of the entire book. And Gary Wills would agree with that. There's a historian or a law professor at Columbia named George Fletcher, and he wrote this, a new constitutional order was created that was nationalism, egalitarianism, and democracy. And so he likes the idea that the Lincoln dictatorship, as he calls it, changed America from a constitutional republic devoted to limited government to egalitarianism, unlimited democracy, and nationalism. James Randall, who was the preeminent Lincoln scholar of the last generation, he said this, great social purposes can be achieved by abandoning constitutional barriers. He wrote a whole big book, a giant book called Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln, and I recommend it. If you want to learn about Lincoln's evisceration of the Constitution, Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln by James Randall, Freedom Under Lincoln by Dean Sprague is also very good as far as that's concerned. If you read those two books, you get a good idea of what happened. And so James Randall, after documenting all of this, for about 1,000 pages, I think. It's a big fat book. This is what he says. It's abandoning constitutional barriers can achieve great social purposes, no doubt. Dean Sprague, in his book, which is very informative, he documents the evisceration of the Constitution. In the last chapter, is entitled, he calls Lincoln a great humanitarian for doing so. Newt Gingrich, in a Wall Street Journal article on September 7th, 06, an article entitled Bush and Lincoln, he makes the case for a U.S. military invasion of Syria, Lebanon, Iran, North Korea, and one or two other countries all at the same time. And he quotes Lincoln throughout the article, claiming that Lincoln would approve of that, therefore Bush should go ahead and do it. And so, and of course, the Constitution requires Congress to declare war, which it hasn't done in many, many decades. But here's Newt Gingrich invoking Lincoln to encourage politicians who might be just as crazy as he is to do this, to have the president wage war without invoking congressional vote, because Lincoln did it, after all. Then there's Eric Foner. He's a Columbia University historian, and whose latest book I reviewed in Barron's Magazine on the January 6th issue of Barron's Magazine. And I blogged it on lewrockwell.com, so you can find my review there if you look for it. But he's a Marxist historian and sort of the dean of Civil War historians now that James McPherson has retired from Princeton. And in his February 11th, 1991 article in The Nation magazine, he opposed the breakup of the Soviet Union. And the title of the article was Lincoln's Lesson. And so once again, he invokes Abe Lincoln and his creation of a dictatorship to oppose the breakup of the Soviet Union. And he says that essentially the Soviet Union, like the American Union during Lincoln's time, was a noble experiment and it should not have been broken up. That's Eric Foner. And so the point of all this is that you have academics and politicians and other people calling Lincoln a dictator, saying he was a good dictator, and making the case for dictatorship. And it's you know, kind of shocking to some people. But when you think about it, historically, there's always been a clique within the U.S. government and its supporters who wanted to do this, beginning with the John Adams administration. And so and I would contrast this, I'm going to talk about some of the things Lincoln did in eviscerating the Constitution in a little bit. Well, I might as well get into it now. I can quote George Washington later. But start with the first thing, waging war in the southern states. If you read Article 3, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution, which defines treason, I've mentioned this before, this is what it says. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And so everything there is in the plural with regard to the United States. The United States is in the plural. And treason against the United States shall consist and living war against them, the states. So the very clear definition in the Constitution of treason is anybody who wages war against the independent and sovereign states. And that, of course, is exactly what Abe Lincoln did. He redefined treason on his own to mean any criticism of him or his administration. And I'll explain how he got away with that shortly. And so the very idea of the central government that was supposed to protect, created to supposedly protect the constitutional liberties of Americans, was not permitted to wage war on Americans. And of course, Lincoln never admitted that secession was legal, so he always considered the southern states to be American states, not a foreign government. And so he always knew that he was waging war on his own country and his own people. And there was never any debate over that. And of course, there was no constitutional authority of any kind for doing any such thing. At the time he was inaugurated, the five living presidents at the time were all opposed to the idea of the central government invading any sovereign state for any reason. And of course, he didn't invade to free the slaves at all. here's how extreme Lincoln was with regard to his crackdown on free speech. You know, he illegally suspended the writ of habeas corpus. The writ of habeas corpus can be suspended under the Constitution, but it has to be suspended by Congress. You know, that's not much solace to those of us who you know, are opposed to governmental tyranny, but that's what the Constitution says. Even Lincoln's own Attorney General, Robert Bates, told him that it was illegal what he was doing, suspending the writ of habeas corpus. And of course, this is our main defense against arbitrary imprisonment by the state. It guarantees some kind of due process. We have a right to confront our accusers, a right to a jury trial for criminal cases, and so forth. And that was all suspended so that the military could drag you out of your home, throw you into a dungeon, and not even notify your family or anybody. And that happened. There were many tens of thousands of northern civilians who were put in prison like that, including newspaper editors, the mayor of Baltimore, a congressman from Maryland, 2 dozen members of the Maryland state legislature were thrown into prison. And so, you know, the president takes an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, and the Constitution of the United States says that the federal government shall guarantee a Republican form of government in the states. And so imprisoning duly elected state legislators is not the way to assure a Republican form of government. Neither does military occupation of those states, which happened during and after the war for 10 years during Reconstruction. So none of this was constitutional at all. The war itself was unconstitutional. The war itself was also a violation of the Second Amendment because firearms were confiscated en masse, as far as that's concerned. And Lincoln was so adamant about redefining treason as criticism of him, that he even said at one point that treason consisted of just merely remaining silent. I'll quote exactly what he said. This is from the Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln, edited by Roy Bassler, which is online. This is the source that historians use for Lincoln quotes and Lincoln speeches and so forth. Volume 6, page 264, Lincoln says this: "The man who stands by and says nothing when the peril of his government is discussed cannot be misunderstood. If not hindered, he is sure to help the enemy. Much more if he talks ambiguously, talks for his country with buts and ifs and ands," end quote. So he was saying, if somebody is discussing the war and you just sit there and remain silent, that is an act of treason. And of course, you could be hanged for treason in theory. You know, that's one of the penalties for treason under the Constitution. And so any discussion of the Lincoln administration in a negative way was deemed to be treasonous, which has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual constitutional definition of treason. And so all of these people, the number of people who are thrown into Lincoln's gulags ranges from the mainstream historians say it was 13,000, but you can't really trust anything they say, in my opinion. The highest estimate I've seen was about 30,000 from a Columbia University Law Review article from way back in the 1920s that I looked at one time in my research. So there were tens of thousands of northern civilians that were dragged into prison in this way and put in places like Fort Lafayette in New York Harbor. And Dean Sprague, the author of the book Freedom Under Lincoln, said that in these gulags, these dungeons, it was the only place in the northern states where there was genuine free speech. Because if you're already in jail for speaking freely, what have you got to lose? You might as well speak your mind. And I've written about this on the web in a few articles, and I've had lots of emails from people in Eastern and Central Europe who lived under communism, and they were telling me that it was the same thing under communism for the most part. My old friend Yuri Maltsev, who's associated with the Mises Institute and was actually an economic advisor of Mikhail Gorbachev before he defected from the Soviet Union in the late 80s, and he told a story once to me that his neighbor in the apartment building where he lived, every day she would open the door and shout out praise for the government out the door. And Yuri tells me that one day he finally asked her, why are you doing this? And of course the answer was she didn't want to be suspected as not being with the Communist Party. She didn't want trouble. And so so the people who lived under those tyrannies understood that being silent and keeping your mouth shut can be very dangerous. And that was Lincoln's position also. Lincoln did a lot to destroy the separation of powers. And of course, since he was a dictator, as these generations of historians described it, this was one of the ways he got away with establishing dictatorial power. He issued an arrest warrant for the Chief Justice, Roger B. Taney, after Taney issued an opinion as a circuit court judge. Back in those days, Supreme Court judges were also circuit court judges, that Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus was unconstitutional. Now, Lincoln could have gone to court and challenged that, but instead he issued an arrest warrant to Taney. And this first came about, was made public, in a book by a man named Ward Lehman, who was a lawyer who worked for Lincoln. He was an old friend of Lincoln's. And the Lincoln cult, as I call it, responded by saying Lehman was a drunk. You can't depend on what he's saying, but that raises the question, well, if he really was an alcoholic, a dangerous alcoholic, what is he doing working as a counsel in the White House? For one thing, why is he a trusted associate of Abe Lincoln if he's such an unreliable person? And wasn't Ulysses Grant known as a drunk also, but a good drunk, I guess? So anyway, for years and years, they did that. They said, ignore this. This didn't happen. Ward Lehman said it happened, and you can't trust Ward Lehman's word. But then in some of my research and research by Charles Adams, we found out there is many other corroborating sources of this. One of them is the memoirs of Benjamin Robbins Curtis. Benjamin Robbins Curtis was the Supreme Court justice who wrote the dissenting opinion in the famous Dred Scott case in 1857. In fact, he resigned from the Supreme Court over the Dred Scott case in 1857. And Taney himself was the Chief Justice at the time who wrote the majority opinion in the case. And in Benjamin Robbins Curtis's memoirs, he says that he knew that an arrest warrant had been issued for Taney, Judge Taney, who at the time was about 83 years old. And also Mayor Brown of Baltimore, who was a personal friend of Taney's, in his memoirs, he wrote about it. And then there's a history of the Federal Marshal Service that also talks about it. So there's documentation that it did in fact happen. And so on top of that, in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quote a document that I got from the archives that was from a federal judge in Washington, D.C., who was a letter he was writing to his fellow federal judges explaining why he did not show up in court. And he was explaining that he was about to issue a writ of habeas corpus to a young man who had been accused of criticizing the Lincoln administration. And when he got home, his home was, in the evening, his home was surrounded by armed soldiers. And the armed soldiers stayed there all night and into the next day and wouldn't let him go to court to issue the writ of habeas corpus. And I suspect there must have been a lot of that going on, and that this one letter is not the only incident of that. And so judges were intimidated by soldiers with guns, in order to enforce Lincoln's illegal suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. And the Republican-controlled Congress got around to rubber-stamping this, and so they were guilty of the same thing. And then after the war, the war was over in 1866, the Supreme Court, in a case Ex parte Milligan, wrote that it was illegal for either Congress or the President to have suspended habeas corpus, because the civil courts in the northern states were operating, and the decision was, as long as the civil courts are operating, it is not legitimate for anybody to suspend habeas corpus. But that was after the Lincoln dictatorship was over, that the Supreme Court had the nerve to take him on and say that. You also had, of course, the shutting down of, according to James Randall in his book Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln, he shut down over 300 northern newspapers. Not every single one. There were some heroic newspaper men who got the word out for a while. But that must have been enough to intimidate everybody. And so so the freedom of the press was pretty much obliterated during the time. And I think I'll read to you a few things. I read a review of a book that was published a couple years ago by two historians, and it's called Lincoln's Wrath. The subtitle is Fierce Mobs, Brilliant Scoundrels, and a President's Mission to Destroy the Press. I reviewed it on LouRockwell.com, and the title of the article is A President's Mission to Destroy the Press. But here are a few things that historian Jeffrey Manber and Neil Dahlstrom, Manber and Dahlstrom, say about this. They said that editors and writers of anti-war newspapers were subjected to myriad punishments. Some were tarred and feathered. Some were thrown into federal prisons and held without trial for months at a time. Others were forced to change their opinions and publish only glowing praise of government actions. Now, this is under the Lincoln regime. They go on to say the Republican regime was created, quote, a forgotten generation of editors, writers, and publishers who dared to express their anger that the Constitution was being trampled. And they were imprisoned and roughed up. And some of them were even murdered, according to these two authors. There was a newspaper that they spent a lot of time in this book, Lincoln's Wrath, talking about a newspaper named the Jeffersonian in Westchester, Pennsylvania. And they detail exactly how the editors and owners were roughed up, intimidated, and eventually put the paper out of business. They say this, the Jeffersonian subscription lists were destroyed, the printing type was thrown out of the window, and the huge printing press was broken. Now, why did they do that? Manber and his co-author explained, and here's what they said. The owner of this paper, the Jeffersonian, and the fact that it was called the Jeffersonian tells you something. His name was John Hogson. He said his paper was targeted, right, Manber and Dahlstrom, because his editorial positions were, quote, diametrically opposed to the centralization of the federal government. He opposed the issue of federally imposed taxes, most especially to pay for the war. He was opposed in general to the intrusion of the federal government, which is what he saw as the decisive and underlying purpose of Lincoln's war. And so for that, he was destroyed. You may have learned in school somewhere that before Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, there was a man named Edward Everett who gave a big long-winded speech right before Lincoln gave his speech at the Gettysburg battlefield. And during this time, these authors talk about he also publicly urged mobs of Republican Party hacks, political hacks, to literally destroy the opposition newspapers. So the distinguished and famous Edward Everett was just a sort of a Republican Party goon who was going out there making public speeches with the approval of Lincoln, because everyone knew he was in with Lincoln. He was on the podium with Abe Lincoln during the Gettysburg Address, for goodness sake. He was instructing people, mobs of Republican supporters, to literally destroy the printing presses of opposition newspaper. They say this, they go on to say in this book that the Republican Party, at no time did Lincoln speak out against the mobs, nor did he speak out in favor of freedom of the press or maintaining America's core values during wartime. And at the same time, they talk about how they lavishly subsidized the Republican newspapers. Okay, the newspapers that were supported by the Republican Party, and they talk about how two dozen editors of Republican Party newspapers were given appointments in the Lincoln administration. So they totally controlled the press, and there could not possibly be a starker difference between this and Thomas Jefferson and his ideal of freedom of the press. Jefferson's authorship of the Kentucky Resolve of 1798 was a protest against the Sedition Act, which banned free speech by the Adams administration. So here you have Lincoln doing everything humanly possible to ban free speech in the northern states, and he's totally diametrically opposed to Jefferson. And that's why one of the reasons why it is absolutely ridiculous to read, as you sometimes do, from Lincoln cultists, that Lincoln was some kind of Jeffersonian only because he mouthed the words of "all men are created equal" in the Gettysburg Address. Nothing could be further from the truth of calling Lincoln a Jeffersonian, as far as that is concerned. And so, you know, I mentioned that the Lincoln administration arrested members of the Maryland legislature, which they did. And I'll read you one quote about this from Dean Sprague. He talks about how in May of 1861, a special election was held to fill 10 empty seats in the Maryland State Assembly. And the Lincoln administration was worried that these people would meet and talk about secession. And so they were all sent to military prison without due process. And here's what Dean Sprague says about this in his book, Freedom Under Lincoln. It says, "This was perhaps the only election in American history in which every man who was nominated and elected went to prison or into exile shortly afterwards." So they were all rounded up and thrown in jail immediately, even though Lincoln had taken a pledge to make sure that each state had a Republican form of government. Didn't really work out that way. There was the suppression of elections in the northern states. Another book that I would recommend, I think I mentioned it, I might have mentioned it last week, and he has three books. His name is William Marvel, M-A-R-V-E-L. And his book, he has a book on Lincoln's first year of the war. And one of the things he documents there is that the Democrats running for Congress were imprisoned without due process days before the election and accused of treason on some sort of trumped up charges. And then shortly after the election, they were let out of prison. So that's one way in which the Lincoln administration rigged the northern elections. Another way, another thing that they did, and this has been written about for a long, long time, is in some places they issued ballots in different colors so that the soldiers who were at the polling place could identify the Democrats and intimidate them and keep them from going in to vote while allowing the Republicans to vote. The Lincoln administration would furlough Republican members of the Army and leave the Democrats out there in the field where they couldn't get to a voting place. They allowed Republican members of the Army to vote in different states. If the Army happened to be in Virginia, they could still vote even though they were from New Hampshire, something like that. But the very first thing they did to rig the Congress, and this is documented by Marvel also, is there was a senator from Indiana named Senator Jesse Bright. He was expelled from the United States Senate in 1861 by the rest of the Senate, which at the time was totally controlled by the Republicans, because the Southern Democrats had left. Their states had, most of them had seceded at the time. And they declared that they were kicking him out of the Senate for what they called retroactive treason. And the reason for this was that he was known to have socialized with Jefferson Davis back when Jefferson Davis was a senator from the state of Mississippi. So there were fellow senators serving in the Senate of the United States, and they were known to go out and have a drink at once in a while, and that was called retroactive treason. And of course, he was a Democrat, and he was opposed to the suspension of habeas corpus and the high taxes, protectionist tariffs, and so forth. He was a Jeffersonian. And so they began literally getting rid of the oppositions. It didn't start with Vallandigham, who was deported. It started with Senator Jesse Bright, who was kicked out of the Senate 2 years before Vallandigham. And speaking of Congressman Vallandigham, you know, I've written about him. If you read my book, or the chapter of my book, you read about Vallandigham. He was in some of his speeches were really inspiring. I've read all of his speeches that he made in Congress criticizing the Lincoln administration. He sounded just like Thomas Jefferson in defending civil liberties and being suspicious of mercantilism and high taxes, high tariffs, and so forth. He also sounded a lot like Lysander Spooner in Spooner's condemnations of the Lincoln administration. And for that, he was deported. He was out, he resigned from Congress Well, he didn't resign. He was gerrymandered out of his seat by the Republican Party, and then he went back home to Ohio to run for governor, and he continued saying the same kinds of things. He thought that there was still a semblance of free speech in America, but in April of 1863, 67 armed federal soldiers broke into his home in the middle of the night, dragged him out of there, and they wanted to make a big deal, a big show about how Vallandigham was supposedly a traitor. So they brought him to Tennessee and handed him over to a Confederate commander, Confederate Army commander in Tennessee, and the Confederates pretty much said, "What is this? Why do you think we want this guy?" He was making the case for reuniting North and South, and the Southerners at that time did not want to be a part of Abe Lincoln's government. So he left, he went to Canada, and he was in exile in Canada. And then the Republican Party after that, through their propaganda arm known as the Union League, spread really stupid, ridiculous rumors that Vallandigham was some sort of Wizard of Oz character who was orchestrating draft riots in New York City and all these bad things that were happening. And it turned out it was all a lie, of course, but that's wartime propaganda. People sometimes, oftentimes seem to suspend their critical faculties completely when their country is at war. This is something that's been known a long time. And so the government and the politicians know they can get away with things like that. And so Vallandigham, that must have been awfully intimidating to other members of Congress. And so that was another death blow to the separation of powers. Not only did he threaten to imprison the Chief Justice of the United States, but Lincoln also literally deported a member, the most outspoken member of the opposition party, Clement Vallandigham. And they didn't try him. They didn't put him on trial. They knew they would lose. Neither did they put Jefferson Davis on trial after the war. They put him in prison for several years. But the trial would have had to have taken place in Virginia. That's where the alleged crime took place, the crime of secession. And it was unlikely they would have had a jury in Virginia, a jury trial that would have found Jefferson Davis guilty of treason. And besides that, they had some of the best lawyers in the North who volunteered to defend Jefferson Davis, and they eventually did get him out of prison. It was because of their efforts that they got him out of prison. And so, what else? Other acts, other reasons why Lincoln was known as a dictator. As I mentioned, the arrest of the Maryland legislature, the suppression of elections. West Virginia was illegally carved out of the state of Virginia. The Constitution says that to create a new state requires the permission of the legislature of the state as well as the Congress. And of course, the legislature of the state of Virginia did not agree to allow West Virginia to be carved out. And so West Virginia was the last slave state to enter the Union. And it entered under the Lincoln administration. Lincoln administration had orchestrated the whole thing. Lincoln's attorney general also said this was illegal, but Lincoln ignored that. He was a dictator after all. And the government of West Virginia was run from Alexandria, Virginia by the Republican Party, and it guaranteed them another couple of electoral votes in the 1864 election. And so that that also was a shady deal. Okay. So this might be enough. I mean, this is a lot of horror stories to tell about Lincoln's actual behavior. When I debated Harry Jaffa, sort of who I call the high priest of the Lincoln cult, shortly after my book, The Real Lincoln, came out, I said all these things, and I told the audience, this was at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California, I told the audience where to find the information on this. I cited chapter and verse, the books, and so forth, where they could read these things. And then Harry Jaffa gets up and says, nothing Abraham Lincoln ever did was unconstitutional, and the whole place erupted in laughter. I don't know if it's on the soundtrack or not of the debate. They might have edited that out, but the whole place is just sort of knee-slapping laughter, because there were a lot of people in there who were pretty well-read on this subject, and they knew that the history of it is that, well, Lincoln was a dictator. He did do these things, but historians call him a good dictator. So there was no debate over whether he did these things in the eyes of generations of historians, except for Harry Jaffa and his followers. They still say these things. And it's the same people, the neocons at places like the Fairmont Institute, for example, that are next week, I think, is the CPAC convention, Conservative Political Action Convention in Washington, D.C., and they're giving the Republican activists, who are also sort of Lincoln cultists, are giving Donald Rumsfeld the Defender of the Constitution Award, of all things. And so that's the type of surreal things that happen that you run across with the Lincoln cult, as I call it, of Harry Jaffa saying things like this right in the face of all these facts, historical facts that are plainly, ridiculously clear, and he denies them. And how you can get away with that, I guess they think it's just mere repetition. And so I think that's enough for now for me to talk about the destruction of the Constitution and why Lincoln was an enemy of the Constitution. And to this day, as I said, politicians, academics, and others always invoke Lincoln whenever they want to justify some illegal act of some kind. And so even the president of Pakistan, as I mentioned earlier, has done it. We've got Newt Gingrich on the right, Eric Foner on the left, doing the same sort of thing. And it's an old game, but I think we're making progress. The more books that are written like this, like not only mine, but the Dahlgren and Manber book that I mentioned, William Marvel, the truth is out there. You can find it out. And more people are understanding this. And the last ditch effort of defense that is made, and Lincoln made this defense himself, and he recognized what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. And he said, well, of course, after the war, all of this will change. We'll go back to a normal constitutional government. But that's never true. There's a very well-documented ratchet effect of government growth. Robert Higgs wrote what is now a classic book called Crisis and Leviathan, where he documents, beginning after the Civil War, actually, beginning the late 19th century, that every time there's some sort of emergency or crisis, like a war, governmental powers ratchet up, and then when the war or the crisis of whatever it is over, governmental powers diminish, but they never diminish back to where the starting point was. And so all of Lincoln's precedents with regard to the Constitution did establish precedents that have been carried forward. That's why you have people like his law professor, George Fletcher, historian Gary Wills, Eric Foner, praising Lincoln to this day, because they're in favor of sort of unlimited governmental power. They're either left-wing liberals or socialists or Marxists of some kind, or they're militarists like Newt Gingrich, who want unlimited executive power. And so that's why Lincoln's behavior was so long-lasting and so negative with regard to the Constitution. But that's their last-ditch effort, as to quote Abe Lincoln himself, is saying, well, things will return to normal later, but they never do. And so maybe I'll wrap it up there. I have about 8:15, been going for 45 minutes, and I do have I did have two questions that I printed out right before the class that were on the questions for the professor. And so I'll address those first, and then I'll go through some of the other questions that you have there. And then the first question I have was Mike Wilborn. And Mike is sick and tired of being misinformed about a lot of things, global warming and so forth, and he says Lincoln worship is just more of the same. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to make the connections. Well, I agree with that. I mean, if you look at the references in my book, The Real Lincoln, I didn't go to the archives of Sons of Confederate Veterans or something like that. They're all mainstream books and articles published by university presses and that sort of thing. So the facts are out there. You can get most of the facts. But it's the interpretation of the facts that can be problematic. And so he says, Lincoln worship is just the same. At some point, the producers are going to say, no more and Lincoln establishes bad precedents. He wants my thoughts if there's any way to tie the lessons about the Lincoln, I guess, propaganda about this. Okay, lack of honest dialogue. Well, this is a very strange thing. You know, I'm an economist by training, and for decades, you know, first 20 years of my career before I wrote anything about Lincoln, you know, I've published dozens of academic journal articles and books, and I've attended many, many conferences, and what we academics do, we write a paper, we go to a professional conference, and there's usually some peer review commentary on it, and the purpose is really to try to get you to think straight and make sure what you're saying is as truthful as you can be, and you know, and so, and there's an ongoing process, and so in general it's been very helpful to me throughout my whole career going to the economics conferences and getting peer review from people, and the whole purpose of that though is to get at some kernel of truth about economic reality. That's the whole purpose of these conferences. Then when I started writing about Lincoln, it was just the opposite. The whole purpose of so much of the writing is to obfuscate truth about history, to dream up interpretations like Harry Jaffa saying, Lincoln never did anything that was unconstitutional. My favorite quote from him is, Lincoln opposed making voters or jurors of Negroes in the 1850s so that Negroes could be voters and jurors today. And so you see this sort of thing. So you go to their conferences, and the discussion is not serious criticism of things that are not really documented well enough. It's sort of creative thinking about how to rationalize this bad behavior. That's why I've written in a lot of my writings that in most Lincoln books that I read, they all sound like defense briefs in the war crimes trial of Abe Lincoln. So they have an excuse for everything. But there are facts in there. And if you educate yourself in the meaning of libertarianism and the history of liberty, you know, read the book Liberalism by Ludwig von Mises, if you want to do that. That's the book to read. And if you educate yourself in free market economics, that'll give you a very superior lens through which to read through some of these books if you happen to be interested in Lincoln, Civil War history, and so forth. So if you do that, if you educate yourself in the history of liberalism and read liberalism, it's online for free on Mises.org, and educate yourself in basic economics in one lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Read that book if you're just getting started in studying economics. You'll look at a lot of this in a very different light, and that's the way to do it. And I guess that's all I can say about that. Second question from Rob Mack. Lincoln's violations of the Constitution were outrageous. He asked about the guys in the Army who were physically carrying out those violations when they were ordered to do so. Were the Union Army, in some particular cases, federal agents, such as marshals? Let's see. In my research, have I come across any evidence of Union officers who expressed second thoughts? Well, certainly. I dug up a reference on this, and you know, one officer, General McClellan, who was the commanding general of the Army of the Potomac, the main Union Army at the time of the Battle of Antietam or Sharpsburg, you know, depending on whether you're a Northerner or a Southerner, they used different words for the same battle. He protested to Lincoln that the soldiers had been looting and plundering private homes and private property in Virginia and elsewhere, you know, during the first months of the war, and he was kicked out of his command not long after that. And so McClellan himself didn't approve of this much. And as far as you know, officers who didn't approve, I wrote one of my articles on lewrocklaw.com, get another one, entitled "The Call of the Tyrant." Does a short review of a book entitled Desertion During the Civil War by Ella Lawn, L-O-N-N, Desertion During the Civil War. And I'll read you a few of the things that her sources for facts in this book are the official records of the War of the Rebellion And these are the official reports written by all the officers and generals and so forth on both sides of the war, during the war. They're all collected in major university libraries, all have copies of the official records of the War of the Rebellion. I'm pretty sure it's online now. And so, and this was, you know, way back, 50 years ago that she wrote this book. But it's all based on the best source of information that exists, the official records. And here are some of the things she said about some of Lincoln's generals. And although General McClellan had 180,000 men on his official roster prior to the Battle of Antietam, he had no more than 90,000 during the battle itself. So 90,000 deserters. In June of 1862, General Buell reported from Tennessee, this is a Union general, that 14,000 officers and soldiers were absent from his command, 14,000. When General Hooker took command of the Army of the Potomac in January of 1863, this was right after the Battle of Fredericksburg, desertions were occurring at the rate of several hundred a day. About 25% of his army was absent, according to the official records. And there was still massive desertion, according to L.L. Lawn, taking place as late as the spring of 1865. She goes on to write that General Henry Halleck complained to Lincoln that, quote, hundreds of officers were almost continually absent from their commands, and that about 200 more were absent without leave every month. According to the official records, according to L.L. Lawn in her book on desertions during the Civil War, 100,000 deserters from the Union Army deserted in 1862 alone. When General Hooker took control of the Army, he found that 2,923 commissioned officers were missing, along with 82,188 non-commissioned officers and privates. 82,000. And so the largest number of deserters were from New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Jersey. And so the Lincoln administration throughout had a policy of hanging deserters and hanging them in front of the other soldiers. And this sort of links into the forgery that was discovered last week. I think Danny put it up on the public chat last week in my blog about it from lewrockwell.com. There was a historian who wrote a book about Lincoln and his pardoning of deserters, and he forged a document that was a pardon that Lincoln signed in April of 1864. He snuck a pen into the National Archives and changed the document to say April of 1865, which would have made it the very last thing Abe Lincoln did before he was assassinated. And so he wrote this whole book about how compassionate Abe Lincoln was, because, you know, here he was about to be murdered, and he was still pardoning the poor mentally retarded soldier from wherever he was. Turns out to be a total hoax and a fraud. But the whole story of Lincoln being a compassionate pardoner of deserters is a fraud. If you look at L.L. Lawn's book, which is based on the official records, she says this: the Lincoln government, quote, had no compunction about shooting or hanging deserters. And here's how she describes how they went about it. And I'm quoting, a gallows and shooting ground were provided in each corps, and scarcely a Friday passed during the winter of 1863-64 that some wretched deserter did not suffer the death penalty in the Army of the Potomac. The death penalty was so unsparingly used that executions were almost daily occurrences in most of the armies, wherever the armies were. And so, and she talks about how, you know, here's how they did it. I'm quoting L.L. Lawn. The condemned men marched out between the two ranks of the regiment, preceded by the musicians playing a funeral march. The provost guard, as an escort, carried the coffin. The victim was conducted to the edge of the grave, which had already been dug. After the sentence was read, he was seated, blindfolded, and placed upon a board at the foot of the open coffin, into which he fell backwards when the firing squad had discharged its sad duty. So it had sort of Nazi-like efficiency in murdering these mostly conscripts who were conscripted in the army in the first place, and then if they tried to desert, they were murdered by the Lincoln administration. And so, yeah, that's a long-winded answer to the question about army officers, but there was massive desertion. And the notion that there was national unity is another one of the biggest lies ever told about American history, national unity in the North. There were these massive desertions. Lincoln conscripted hundreds of thousands of Northern men. He also used hundreds of thousands of mercenaries from Europe to man his armies. And so it wasn't as friendly as the historians let on to be. Let's see. Let me read through some of the public chat now. Yeah, well, I mentioned Rumsfeld and Lincoln. Well, you know, during the Bush administration, they did such things as the Patriot Act, and Bush wanted to suspend habeas corpus, and Rumsfeld was on board with that, and so he was part of sort of the neoconservative movement that always, first and foremost, invokes the image of Abe Lincoln to justify such things as suspension of habeas corpus, warrantless wiretaps. They got away with doing that, not going before a judge, before wiretapping a telephone, that sort of thing. So that's sort of why I made a passing reference to some of the same people in the Republican Party circles today who write these things about Lincoln being a champion of the Constitution are throwing parties for Donald Rumsfeld for also being a champion of the Constitution somehow. And in each case, it's farcical, I think. But he did support this. Yeah, he was Secretary of Defense, but he did. It would have been the Defense Department people who would have been working hand in hand with pointing the finger at who they wanted to be spied upon or arrested and imprisoned. Let's see, I'll get some. I'll go up here and see some questions. Hundreds of thousands of foreign mercenaries, mostly from Europe, of course. There were a lot of Irish mercenaries, a lot of Germans. There were a lot of Germans. There's a book called Melting Pot Soldiers that talks about the Europeans. There were also a lot of people who were called 48ers. There were these sort of socialistic communist revolutions in Europe in 1848, and a lot of these utopians who participated in these revolutions in Europe, which did not succeed, came to America, and many of them were from Germany, and many of them ended up as officers in Lincoln's army, and so a lot of them were. You had the spectacle, for example, of the Union Army commander in the Battle of New Market, where the cadets from VMI, Virginia Military Institute, left school and marched up to the battlefield. Many of them died. One of them was related to Thomas Jefferson. Well, I think it was the grandson of Jefferson's, one of Jefferson's brothers, something like that. But it was a Jefferson who was killed in the Battle of New Market. And you had a German immigrant who barely spoke English, who was the commanding officer, who was leading troops into Virginia to teach Virginians, the sons, literally the sons of some of the founding fathers and grandsons and great-grandsons of the founding fathers, teach them what it meant to be an American. That's ostensibly what they were doing. And so you had a lot of German and Irish immigrants that participated in Lincoln's army. They were promised land through the Homestead Act after 1862. And of course, many of them never got the land. They were killed in battle. But that was one of the promises. Okay, well, I'm just gonna pick these, not necessarily any order. Does the original Declaration of Independence have the word states beginning in lowercase? All the founding documents, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, use the word United States in the plural. It was the United States are, not is. And that's the significant part, because also if you read the Declaration of Independence, At the end, it says that these are free and independent states. Those are the exact words, free and independent. And then it asks the question, well, free and independent to do what? And it says to raise taxes and wage war and do all things that states can do. And so when they use the word states, they thought the state of Virginia was thought to be a state like Great Britain was a state, like France or Spain were states. They thought of themselves as independent countries. That's why when Robert E. Lee was offered the job of commanding general of the Union Army at the beginning of the war, before he left the U.S. Army, he said, I can paraphrase him, I can't raise my sword against my country. And so people at that time considered their state to be their country. And it's significant that it's always in the plural, the words United States. It was only after the war that there was this monolithic thing called the United States government that people talked about. Previous to that, it was always in the plural. The famous Civil War author Shelby Foote, who wrote this great trilogy called The Civil War, about all the battles and everything, when he was interviewed on C-SPAN, which is I'm sure it's on the C-SPAN archives, he said the most important thing to come of the Civil War was the country was transformed from the United States are to the United States is. He said that was the biggest change that happened. Let's see, Danny has the Lincoln forgery press release from the National Archives. Why did so many immigrants come if they knew they were going to fight? Well, a lot of them were 48ers, like I said. They thought that the Lincoln Revolution would be some sort of revolution that could lead to something similar to what they wanted in Europe, a highly centralized socialistic government, and they were right about that. And we'll talk about that in a week or two. But they had experience in fighting, fighting for some sort of socialistic utopia, and they thought this was another chance to achieve that. Let's see. McBean, let's see, M. Bean, in my opinion, what is the biggest hurdle that must be overcome for a typical self-identified small government states' rights conservative to accept the truth about Lincoln? Well, you have to be a hard-nosed pursuer of the truth and not worried about what people are going to say about you. Most academics, I've been an academic for 32 years, and most of them are cowardly and weaselly little bureaucrats who are just counting the days until retirement. And the last thing they want is any kind of controversy. That's why so many economists spend their entire careers publishing sort of useless, trivial claptrap that nobody cares about and no one ever reads in the obscure journals that they publish. They know that it won't create any controversy at work. They can go to lunch with all the leftists who totally and completely dominate academia. And it's a pleasant work experience. They teach their classes and they go home. They don't want to knock over a hornet's nest. And so so you have to be strong-willed in educating yourself and keep in mind that your objective is to learn as much truth as you can and not be swayed by the opinion of others who are much lazier than you and are not putting forth the effort. That's just my two cents on that. Let's see. How do you get a Lincoln Prize? There are all kinds of Lincoln Prizes, and there are, it depends on who's funding it. There are different funding sources. A lot of it's the government, like National Endowment for the Humanities. There are foundations that have been set up to give out Lincoln Prizes. I'm still waiting for my first Lincoln Prize. Let's see, Cliff. Well, Cliff is just making a comment, I guess, no question. Has Hillsdale College become another nest of Lincoln lovers? Yes, it certainly has. You know, one of the most ridiculous nests of Lincoln lovers is the Claremont Institute in California. It's where I mentioned Harry Jaffa. That's students of his founded the Claremont Institute. And the president of Hillsdale College is the former executive director of the Claremont Institute. And so, they're putting up a statue of Lincoln, a statue of Winston Churchill. And Hillsdale seems to be being turned into a sort of a foreign policy interventionism academy, in my opinion. I'm on their mailing list. I have been for 30 years, and it's radically changed since it was taken over by the neocons. And Larry Arnn, the president of Hillsdale, was the former executive director of sort of the Lincoln Cult Central, the Claremont Institute. Let's see. See, Lincoln didn't personally carry out these acts, no. Let's see. What is it that makes other people carry out these terrible acts, such as Lincoln's? Well, the soldiers that arrested those people. Well, you know, I'm not a psychologist. Careerism, threats of punishment, threats of being put in prison. You know, once you're a military officer, if you disobey an order that came directly from the commander in chief, you'll be put in prison. And so, who wants to be put in prison? And so I guess that's what they're doing. Yeah, you know, Lincoln was enabled by others, but he was by far the biggest enabler of all of them as well, because he was sort of a quite masterful in his rhetoric to make up excuses. Every time he would get caught doing something, he would be the one who would come up with the rhetoric. I mentioned one example of when he was criticized for deporting a member of Congress. He said, must I shoot the poor boy who deserts? Well, not touching a hair on the head of the wily agitator who causes him to desert. You know, and a lot of members of the public will hear that and say, well, yeah, that makes sense. And so he was enabling the people who were enforcing his policies by using that kind of rhetoric as far as that's concerned. But yes, he had a lot of help. William Seward was his henchman. He was sort of the early version of a KGB chieftain. He bragged once publicly that he could ring a bell and have any person in America thrown into prison without due process. And he bragged that no king of England ever had such power to do such a thing. So yes, he did have a lot of help, he had all the Republican Party big shots were all in on it. That's true. I've never claimed that he did all this all by himself. Let's see if I scroll up here and get a few more. Yeah, Rummy is getting that honor, and he has a book signing at CPAC the exact same hour as Tom Woods is having a book signing. Okay, let's see. Ms. Tim, I homeschool my kids. Can I recommend a good and reliable history book on the War of Northern Aggression? Oh, what's this author? Search on Amazon.com for a book with the title The War Between the States. I looked at this book once and it seemed very good. It was written by a man who's the headmaster of a private Christian school. And I looked at it over. He did a really nice job in just laying out facts about the war. And I think it's just called The War Between the States, and it's sort of a high school level textbook. Off the top of my head, I can't think of his name. But I'll dig it up. I own a copy of it. He sent me a copy of it, so I'll put it on the one of the forums after the class, so you can get it. But if you Google around or go on Amazon, there are probably a number of books called The War Between the States. This one was published, I think, about 5 years ago. And And so you'll probably find it if you look for it. Let's see. Let's see what else we have here. Dennis wants to tear down the statues at Hillsdale College. Yeah, Chris Bankley, yeah, John Dwyer, I think that's the name of the author. Yeah, Chris knows the, yeah, here it is, Bill here has, yeah, John Dwyer is the name of the author of that book. It's for, you know, for junior high or high school kids, I think it's a pretty good book. And of course, there's the Pig series, the Politically Incorrect Guide. There's Tom Woods' Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, which covers, you know, some of the things about the Civil War, but it doesn't go into any detail at all about, you know, the actual war itself, if you want to educate your kids on that sort of thing. And then there's a Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, which is pretty good also. And so you might want to look at some of those guys. I think are good for junior high school kids. But the one by Dwyer, it's the only one I've seen recently that I would say is good for junior high school age kids. Shelby Foote's big fat book, The Civil War, it's a trilogy, three-part book. If you had maybe a bright 16 or 17-year-old who was really into history, and especially Civil War history, he could read that. It's big, very time-consuming, but it's the book to read about, you know, all the facts and the stories about what happened in the battles and so forth. There's not much politics and economics in it. But if you just want to know what happened, that's an indispensable source. Okay, yeah, Dwyer's the guy. Let's see if we have something else. Dennis saying something about bootlickers. Yeah, that's pretty much true. Okay, I guess we're running out of gas. If there are no more questions, we'll call it a night. It looks like the questions have run down. Now here's Bill. Had Lincoln not been assassinated, speculation on what his second term would have produced, although the centralizing status dominoes started to fall with him. He was a master politician, and so he wasn't alone, of course. He had the Republicans in Congress who ran Reconstruction, and sort of the standard story about Reconstruction is that it wouldn't have been as harsh on the South had Lincoln lived, because there was revenge taken over Lincoln's death about it, supposedly. But what happened during Reconstruction was essentially a 10-year plundering expedition of the southern states. It continued on for 10 years. The ex-slaves were given almost no help at all. They were never given land. You know, if they were really concerned, the population of the country was only 30 million. And the U.S. government owned almost all the land west of the Mississippi River. You know, they never gave the ex-slaves an acre of it. I mean, why didn't they give them, you know, their own state somewhere to go and live in freedom? If they were, you know, they were fighting this war over slavery, they made no attempt to do that. Sherman made a speech where he said something about 40 acres and a mule. No one ever got 40 acres and a mule. But it was the tax increases during Reconstruction were phenomenal at a time when what the South needed was tax amnesty for a decade, because it was destroyed. You know, all the wealth that had been accumulated in the South up to that point had been almost all destroyed by the war. And for example, the property taxes in South Carolina in 1870 were 30 times higher than they were in 1860. And so federal tax collectors would come down, and if you couldn't pay the property tax, they would either confiscate some of your cotton or your tobacco or whatever it is you were growing on your farm, or they would take the farm. And so that's how a lot of the so-called carpetbaggers got rich. They were Republican Party hacks who got jobs as tax collectors, and they did things like that. They issued huge debts, huge numbers of bonds to ostensibly build railroad tracks and things like that. Very little of that was done, and the people of the southern states were put into debt very severely. White adult males for a while were disenfranchised, while all the adult male ex-slaves were registered to vote Republican, and so they helped out in sort of the political plunder of the southern population after the war. And then all of a sudden in 1877, the U.S. Army left, and it left all the ex-slaves defenseless with a population that was out for revenge because many of them had participated in the plundering of Reconstruction. And so it was a horrible mess. But Lincoln, being a master politician, I think he would have reveled in the plundering that was going on. After all, he sort of reveled in what he was doing during the war. And so I dissent from the official view that he was sort of the kindly grandfather who would have made everything better after the war. He was the master string puller of the largest sort of patronage operation ever in the history of the U.S. government up to that point, and he would have reveled in that. Let's see. Aaron says, a trivia question, whatever happened to Clement Vallandigham? Was he deported or was it? Oh yeah, he was deported. He ended up in Canada. Yeah, he came back after the war. He came back and was a practicing lawyer after the war. And he in a murder case that he was litigating, he was demonstrating the use of the pistol in the murder, and he shot himself and died from that. That's how Vallandigham died. And so he did come back after the war. I think there was an old movie made about him. It's called Man Without a Country. I don't think he was elected governor. While he was deported, he was living in Canada. He was the Democratic gubernatorial nominee, or candidate rather, from Ohio. But he didn't win the election. The Republicans had everything rigged. But he was the candidate. The Democratic Party of Ohio nominated him as their candidate to run for governor, even though he was in exile at the time. Let's see. Yeah, any more questions? I'll just sit around here for another short while and see if we have anything else. Doesn't look like it. Well, maybe we'll call it a night then, and then we're going to have I'm going to make up a quiz. The way it works is this is Tuesday. I'll probably get it to Danny by Thursday at the latest, and then he'll open it up online, and you'll have several days to go online and take the quiz if you want to get a grade for the course. And then since it's a short course, there's only two of these, and so it's not a real high pressure thing. Okay, more questions. Okay. I've heard the Battle Hymn of the Republic is hogwash. I don't know if hogwash is the word. You can read Murray Rothbard's interesting comments about it in his essay, Just War. And I'll talk about that at some point. But it was written by a sort of New England post-millennialists who believed that they could not be saved and go to heaven unless they first established a thousand-year kingdom of God on earth. And they thought that all the war and the death of 670,000 people and the destruction of the South was a sign that God is on his way, that we're going to have our kingdom of God on earth, and that because they eradicated the sin of slavery in that way. And that's what the Battle Hymn of the Republic is about. I've always thought it was the creepiest song I ever heard, celebrating all the death of 670,000 people. But I can say more about that at a later time. best sources on Union POW camps and the Lincoln administration's policies regarding Union POW camps. Let's see. And there haven't been too many books written about the Union POW camps. I don't have one on the top of my head about that. That's sort of, it's hard for an historian to have a career writing books about the awful Union Army POW camps. So there are very, very few of them. But I'll do some head scratching and then put it on one of the forums. Bill Hare, the mental whiplash. Well, I guess that's a good thing. Rob has heard that Lincoln's delivered a Gettysburg address isn't the one we read today. I don't know. I've heard some historians quibble that there are some phrases that are a little different, but I don't think there's much. I haven't seen any evidence that there's a big difference in what he actually said from the one that. And I was sort of forced to recite it every day in elementary school in Pennsylvania, by the way. I remember that. Okay. Well, I guess the class is about over. It's 8:52. We're running out of questions. But feel free to email me at tdlo@aol.com if anyone wants to send me a private email about anything related to the class or Lincoln or anything else, or my next course beginning in March on competition, monopoly, and antitrust. It's up on Mises.org right now. And so everybody have a good night, and I hope you enjoyed the class.